So this is the Temple Dynamics of Learning Centre's 2014 All Hands Meeting. We're at the Supercomputer Centre at UCSD, just over in Howard Poisson's lab, actually. And we've just heard an afternoon keynote speech from Mary Helen Imordino-Yang from University of Southern California, the Brain and Creativity Institute at USC. This is our fourth time doing this. Back to the original Brains R Us meeting, and then MBES and Society for Neuroscience and so on. This was probably the most, there's something changed in the way that you're presenting the information now. I should tell you, it was very wonderfully evocative speech, embodied brain, social minds. But there was almost, it was kind of a plea for people to be more engaged with understanding the way in which meaning has to be understood at a neuroscientific level. Do you see what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I mean, I do feel like I'm in a habit of trying to plead with people, if you will, because in an era in education policy in which the focus is on standards and accountability, and standards and accountability are very important, don't get me wrong, I think we're oftentimes leaving out of the discussion what learning actually looks like and what kids are actually going to use their abilities for after they're done with school. And so I feel like I'm almost on the defensive trying to prove to people, like the onus is on me and others who study emotion, to prove to people that it's actually not just a luxury to have emotionally meaningful learning, that if you think you can sort of streamline the process and make it more efficient that way, you're thinking wrongly, that real children are not streamlinable, that by making their curriculums more straightforward, more bare bones, more focus on the basics, take out the emotion, take out the portfolio work, take out the extras and following their own interests, that you're going to, you know, sort of standardize and improve the quality, that's not actually what I think will happen. I think you'll actually turn kids off, and the kids who can actually tolerate that kind of learning and who aren't turned off will have learned things in a very sort of decontextualized way that doesn't connect to anything relevant to their real lives, which is always the other discussion. How do we make things relevant to kids' real lives? And so, you know, the most straightforward way that people think of doing this is to have them learn skills in contexts that actually look like your real life. So if you're going to learn math, well, learn how to write a check. If you're going to learn addition, learn how to balance your checkbook. And I'm not saying you shouldn't learn how to balance a checkbook, but that just doesn't guarantee that the learning is going to be meaningful and transferable out to your real life, just because there's some kind of token real world application as an example given. In the real, I think, way that knowledge will be integrated and transferred so that it's actually useful later, and you'll actually access it and remember it later when you need it, is by making the learning sort of owned in a meaningful, purposeful way in the first place by the child, so that you teach children. One of the main purposes of education is not just to teach them how to do things or what some factual information, but to teach them what it means to know something and how it feels to be an expert on something, and what it means not to know something and what you can do about that, and so we're kind of leaving those out of the equation. So we're in stripping down education, I feel like we're really doing kids a major disservice, and so that's why I sort of come across perhaps with this kind of pleadingness. I'm trying to demonstrate to you, prove to you that emotion is actually fundamental, and it's not a luxury or an add-on after the learning happens.
All right. I could also have said, instead of plea, which I still think is accurate, rallying cry, if you want. So that's the same sort of thing. You gave a couple of you told three stories at the beginning, two or three stories. You told a story about some family in China. You told some stories about your own children and documents that they had sent to you and so on. You told stories. Mm-hmm. Now, what you did there was completely hooked the audience. Mm-mm. I mean, it was very clear. It was wonderfully done. But what you were doing there was putting into practice what you're talking about at the theoretical level here. I mean, and so the stripped down nature in which people are taught things, even at university level, which is to leap over certain hurdles to be given a certificate with which they're not quite sure what they're going to do anyway, without having there been this invoking of feeling about and passion for doing something. That's what you're speaking to, isn't it? I mean,
I think that I am trying to sort of practice what I preach when I incorporate these stories, because if I'm trying to teach an audience about the nature of learning and I'm trying to make a point about emotion, I can make it in the sort of abstract, you know, sense. Right. Like I could put up a bullet point of slides that says emotion is important, make sure that you have emotion in your classroom, but nobody will really understand what that means unless I say, okay, now let me tell you this story. Now you're feeling these kinds of emotions. Stop and examine your own experience. You know, what are the dimensions of that experience? What are the embodied sensations you have? What are the self-related thoughts you're having? You know, and how do those seem to go together? And now let's look at the neural correlates of that process. Then what you're actually doing is helping them to intuitively connect with and understand what it is that we're actually talking about, so we can all experience the same thing. In order, or not necessarily the same thing, but experience something in a systematic way so that we can then have a baseline from which to begin talking, that we know what it is we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since we started talking, I mean, going back from the beginnings of the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center here and the meetings that we put on called Brains Are Us.
Yeah.
For the obvious reason, I mean, if you're going to talk about any of these things, what's the one thing that's common to everybody in the planet? Duh. Mm-hmm. Brain, right? But
well, body too, but yeah.
Well, yes, but an embodied, right, exactly. An intelligence system, including a brain. And how all that works is tremendously important. There's been this wonderful shift over the last 5-6 years. Many more books, magazines, meetings, conferences about all this and the underpinnings of the neuroscience and so on. It's a little bit tricky to sort of navigate at the moment because now we're getting the hype part as well. Mm-hmm. So how do you keep in the right space there? Because that's tricky.
Oh, you mean the sort of sort of voyeuristic appeal of neuroscience?
Yeah. It's what's been,
What's
been called neuroporn by some people.
Yeah, you know, I was trying to avoid that term, but yeah, you can say that. Right, exactly. Well, I try to inoculate my audiences against that by actually helping them to understand what the data represent from a statistical perspective, what they don't mean. You know, for example, these activations that we see are not the regions in the brain that are doing this task. They're the regions in the brain that are relatively extra active when you're doing this task as compared to another task. Everywhere else that's not lit up is equally involved in both tasks, you know?
Right.
And then also helping them to understand that that the logic of using neuroscience to try to inform questions about real world things like education or learning, that the idea is not to just know for the sake of it which gyrus is lighting up for which task, and we don't really care. What, how does that help a teacher at all? But instead, if we can try to map different kinds of cognitive and emotional processes onto different neural systems, then we can use the logic that we already know about that neural system to try to infer something about the nature of the cognitive process. So why is it that emotions, for example, and the experience of emotions is recruiting and reusing and co-opting cortex that is also responsible for somatosensation of the viscera and guts? That tells you something about the nature of what an emotional feeling is, that it's building off of either simulated or real sensations of what's going on in your body, and not just in the part of your body that acts, but in the part of your body that maintains your physiological survival and your homeostatic regulation. So in other words, the sort of efficient functioning of your biological organism. And so by knowing that emotions are tied to our biological selves in such an intimate way as that, we can both start to appreciate how it is that emotions are such powerful motivators in our life, why they feel so powerful to us, and how certain emotions may potentially change the way in which our survival happens. So this is why stress or unhappiness or happiness can change the way in which you get sick or your immune system functions and these kinds of things, is because there's this kind of reciprocal sharing of neural machinery and co-opting of neural machinery. And when we understand it that way, we actually get new insights into the nature of learning itself and into the way that the brain is developing, because you can think of development as a process of increasingly specializing and co-opting these systems that are perfectly functional for their sort of day job, if you will, their physiological day job when you're born. I mean, infants can feel their own guts perfectly fine, but they don't feel admiration for virtue. And so we want to understand, how do you come to recruit those same cortices that have been doing this other job all the way along to do something high level and specific to humans?
Let me push you a little bit more on this, because it is a point that keeps on coming up over and over again. So the argument being that you're wanting people to understand and learn how to feel their emotions and how that impacts their cognition and their actions and the behavior and so on. You could say, well, I don't need to see an MRI to do that. I can just tell that story as you did so well, and I can make that person suddenly think, oh, God, I really should be doing that myself.
Sure.
On the other hand, you could also say, here's this pregnant woman comes into the doctor's office, and we know that she's pregnant, and therefore she's going to feel certain ways. What possible advantage is there to doing a sonogram so she could see the baby in the womb?
Right.
Well, you know that that's a huge difference when people actually do that. Mm-hmm. They have the tremendous additional emotion. Is that the same thing when you think you see when you
so
see
so it makes
brain?
It more
I'm
sort
just,
of real
just
to you.
To drill down.
I think it is. It's always very. it's very awe-inspiring to me to start to appreciate the neurobiological mechanisms that underlie some of our most interesting, human abilities.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think the question for me is not so much what's the neural mechanism, but what can we understand about the nature of the human ability by understanding something about its neural mechanism. So it's really it's an information gathering tool. It's a way of sort of constraining the way that we think about what the ability is, if you will. So and how it comes to be that way. So for example, we have some new data that are just about to be published, in which we looked at how young adults in Beijing Normal University and at USC, both of Asian descent and not of Asian descent, Americans, how they feel these complex social emotions that we have to the same stories. So these are stories that are half about Chinese protagonists, half about American protagonists, and everybody's seeing the same stories, and they see them subtitled in their own language. So you see the real protagonist talking with their real tone of voice, but if you're in Beijing, you're going to see it subtitled in Mandarin, and if you're in the United States, you're going to see it subtitled in English. And so we ask people, how do you feel about this story? How does this story make you feel? And then we ask them to tell us in the scanner when they become aware of how they're feeling as they're watching. And then we're recording psychophysiological data, and we're recording neural data. And what we find, we find a lot of really interesting things. But what we find is, at the biggest picture slice, is that the magnitude of the neural signal that we get in China, in Asian American USC students, and USC students not of Asian descent, in these regions is exactly the same. It's not different, statistically speaking. It's not a different magnitude of signal. We get the same magnitude of emotions that the person reports experiencing. So the people in China are saying they feel as strongly as the people in the United States are feeling to these stories. So you think, and like one of the reviewers for the paper first thought, so you have no effect, right? But that's only where it begins. So we've got the same magnitude of effect everywhere. But what is systematically varying by culture is how the neural signal corresponds to that person's reported strength of feeling in real time. So in other words, the way in which the person reports their feeling, the concomitant or co-occurring neural activity in real time, the way in which these things are moving together, either very tightly correlated together or more loosely correlated together, appears to be related to cultural group. What that tells us is that it doesn't tell us very much about what's going on. except, you know, it's a very blurry look at what's going on. I mean, fMRI data is not very good resolution. But what we can tell from that is that there's something systematically biased or biasing in the effects of culture on how people construct experiences of their own emotions. So somehow, even though we've got the same neural signal and the same feeling, the way in which that neural signal is corresponding to the feeling is different tells us that people are learning how to construct a feeling that corresponds to certain neural states.
So what kind of stories are you using there? I mean,
these are the same kinds of stories. So stories about admiration for, meant to induce admiration for virtue and admiration for skill and compassion for social pain and compassion for physical pain and control stories that are not as remarkable and not as emotional. And actually these relationships hold across all those emotion categories. So it seems to be holding on average across all of the categories. So it's not something specific to a specific emotion. It's more about how people become aware of, potentially, the subjective quality of their own experience.
So, but this is not misunderstanding, is it? I mean, for example, I can tell, I know from personal experience that one tells a certain story to, say, an Asian American and then tells a story to somebody who's visiting for a conference from Taiwan or China or something. And there's something lost, literally the phrase, lost in translation.
Right.
They just don't...
So what we did here...
there's some universals that don't just immediately... kick in there.
Well, yeah, no, of course. I mean, the interpretation is going to be based in the cultural context and cultural ways of knowing. And I'm not saying there's no differences in the ways that people interpret the stories, but the strength of emotions that they have to the stories is the same. And the overall category of emotion that they seem to be describing is the same. Hmm. And we also specifically designed this corpus of stories so that it would translate well. So these are all true stories, which helps a lot. We made sure that half the corpus of stories is about Chinese people and half in China and half is about American people in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And then we made sure that within every emotion category, it's half and half, and those stories are matched by theme. So you don't have stories in China about physicians saving poor people and stories in America about people jumping off bridges to save somebody in the water.
Right. You always
have stories that are kind of about the same idea so that they're well matched. And also so that they're a story that translate well between. And then what we did was we actually looked at people's experiences that they report and the neural activity that they show in relation to stories about people from their own cultural group versus the other cultural group, and we find no effects at all. So we've designed a set of stories that it's specifically meant to translate easily. We've also had experts in comparative literature and in psychology from the two cultural groups look at the stories and pick out stories that they thought might be interpreted differently in one place or the other, and we've removed those. So we've really tried to make a corpus of stories that are well-balanced, well-matched, and that are that culturally move well between the two places.
Okay, so what do you then do with that?
What do I do with that?
Yes, what's the utility of having the information base?
Well, so then you can say that when the people... So what I was hoping is that people in all the cultural groups in the experiment would experience equally strong emotions of the same sort. Because if a story makes one cultural group of people on average angry, while it makes the other cultural group on average compassionate, and then you see differences in the brain, that won't be interesting because you don't know if it's differences in how they feel stories in general and make meaning out of emotion states, or if it's that you're capturing anger in one group and sadness or compassion in the other group. So we needed to have stories that were emotionally well-balanced and well-matched and were equivalent across the cultural groups. And then we can actually show that there's no differences across the cultural groups in how they respond to the stories in terms of the category emotion that they're experiencing and in terms of the strength of the emotion that they're experiencing. And now when we can find systematic differences in how people express their emotion, for example, in an interview on tape, on videotape, and systematic differences in how psychophysiologically reactive they are to the stories and systematic differences in how neural and psychophysiological reactivity are corresponding to real-time reports of experience, we can attribute those not to different categories of emotion being induced and not to a sort of cultural alignment between one or the other group with the content of the stories, but instead to cultural differences in how people construct experience of emotion about stories.
Okay, so how does that, is that translatable back into classrooms, for example?
So it doesn't translate directly, but this is the basic science that we need to do to kind of make us all sit up and say, oh, you mean culture really matters because it's potentially related to how people experience their own life. And when I explain this to teachers or I explain this to people from different cultural groups, lay people, they look at me and say, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, of course, that's true. You doing anything interesting or new? Because we already knew that, you know? But scientists look at you and drop their jaw like, what, really? You know, is that really what you found? So. I think, you know, it's one of those scientific findings that kind of had to be demonstrated.
That's what I'm kind of getting
at. Yeah, so that you can sort of validate people's experience, and then we can work from there to understand, well, what is culture? Because education is a form of acculturation. We take our children, we put them in this system for some major portion of their waking life, and we expect them to behave and to think and to adjust themselves to adapt themselves to this system. And in doing so, we are changing potentially who they are, and that's intentional. We have certain values for how we want our children to be. We want them to get along in groups. We want them to think critically. We want them to do these kinds of things. But in teaching them that, we are potentially changing who they are as people and how they experience their own self, which again is the nature of raising children. That is what you do. But wouldn't it be good if we were doing that in a more mindful and informed way, especially given the state of the American education system being so diverse right now? We have so many different populations of people coming from different places in the world and rubbing shoulders in our education system. We have more immigration around the world right now than we've ever had in any previous generations, and we simply have no idea what that means for how we should be raising our children. And I know that this is a very impoverished, tiny slice, but science is like that. In order to be able to systematize a problem and look at it in a very rigorous way, we need to sort of focus the lens down and at the level of interpretation that we can then start to make grander implications that we can later test and build into more complex and elaborate hypotheses. But for right now, I just wanted to demonstrate or to test whether there would actually be demonstrable neurobiological differences in how people construct feelings of their own emotion.
Well, I mean, an anthropologist would argue. Right, but wouldn't there also be an argument that there's only one universal human nature?
Well, I mean, it depends how broadly you're conceiving of nature. Yes, yeah. We all have a lot. There's an awful lot that we share, right? And so that's our nature. But then. That nature is organized over time in the context of social relationships.
Yeah.
And to the extent that those relationships are sort of systematically biased towards certain values or expectations or norms, another way to say acculturated, then we would expect to see the effects, the developmental effects of those acculturated shifts and biases in the ways that young adults and adults in a society think.
Are you aware of how you've incorporated some of your day work into your own raising of your own children and how you pass that on to class? I mean, it's rather a trite and obvious question, but I mean...
You asked me if I'm aware of it, which kind of assumes, A, that I do it, and you're asking me, do I do it in a mindful way?
Yeah.
And so you're sort of right. That's actually just the right question. So, and so I'm calling you on it because I'm not sure you meant it, but it's true.
No, I did.
So I do it. I mean, how could I help not doing it? I mean, we use what we know in order to do the hardest job we have, which is to raise our children, right? That's one where you there's no right answer there, you know? And I try to be very aware of how I'm using what I know. And also, I try to learn from them. They've taught me huge amounts about what these stages that other people have described actually look like, and the individual variability that can be in them, and how and when they can come out and be evident. So I find them, not that I'm sitting there sort of analyzing all the time in a explicit way, but it's really very interesting to see my kids show me the ways in which they build these skills that we all value so much and that we've talked about so much in development. So like for one example that comes to mind, I remember a time when my son was about I think it was like 2 years, 8 months or something. And that's the scientist in me that I remembered the age, right? Because I thought it was really important. So 2 years, 8 months. And one night he was going to bed and he's walking around the house saying goodnight to everybody. And he's walking around saying, you know, like he would do. And he'd say, goodnight, mommy. Goodnight, daddy. And he's going around, goodnight, Jeje, his sister. And goodnight, you know, Susanne, our au pair who's living with us. And all of a sudden he just stops dead in his tracks in the middle of the kitchen. And he looks at us and he goes, goodnight, myself. And just burst into hysterical laughter. He thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard in his life. And he repeated it over and over, good night, myself. That is so funny. But you know, why is that so funny? It was like the first time when he, presumably, could explicitly recognize that he has a self, yes, and other people have a self, and you can say goodnight to people's selves. So why can't you say goodnight to your own self? But of course, that's ridiculous, because I am myself, right? And that just struck him as hilariously funny. And he went around for the next week, you know, doing all these permutations on it, the way that skills do, right? So this is me imposing, you know, what I know about skill development onto what he was doing. And he's walking around saying, you know, what will I have for lunch today, myself? And, you know, like, how was my day, myself? And laughing. And then after about a week, it got boring and he moved on.
Right.
But then, so that sort of thing that you maybe, that any parent would think was cute, I immediately realized, oh, that's what that is. That's actually him becoming explicitly cognitively aware, right, of his own self and being able to differentiate that from other selves and to be able to mentally represent them both simultaneously, as what we would call a representational mapping, you know? I'm analyzing his behavior, but not because I want to reduce it to something that's lesser than it is. It's an amazing, adorable, incredibly smart little insight that he had. And just because everybody has it doesn't mean that it's not amazing and smart when he has it.
Yeah, I suppose what I was getting at was that obviously, merely because you're working in the field and or an academic, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily observing more acutely. On the other hand, you get this benefit.
I think I do observe acutely, though. I'm just an acute observer.
That's just my nature. You get this benefit of being of having information coming to you that the child is actually delivering.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they give me things, and it's wonderful.
And that they, in a pedagogical situation, that ought to be a good thing.
Oh, terrific. So, absolutely. Because you can go around.
Instead of it all being a one-way street.
Oh, for sure.
My
kids teach me all kinds of things, and we think together about stuff. And they teach me about their view of the world and about their experience of the world. And I try to show them what might be a more adaptive way to experience the world as they become ready for it. And then they kind of give feedback and sort of, you know, kind of adjust the world for the way that suits them.
The tricky thing we always found in those early meetings was that it's so difficult to have all the standards that need to be met and so on and so forth. I mean, if you look at the most recent discussion of where are the best educational systems? It's those PISA scores that come from the OECD.
Yep.
And at the top of the list now, having replaced Finland, is China and various places in Asia and so on. And it's not clear, if you ask people who work in all of those areas, whether what this is a representation of is a representation of educational systems changing or children being trained to take test so that it'll be at the top of the test.
Right.
And that same thing permeates all the way down through the system and into here as well. I mean, how do you... You must be asked to go to talk to schools and so on and talk them how the schools can deliver a richer education at the same time as not losing their efficacy in the job market. I mean, it's
oh, right. You need to have skills. I think that it's what I said at the very beginning. Oftentimes we confuse efficiency with real learning. And kids need to have opportunities to develop, you know, sort of scaffolded, supported opportunities to develop very basic abilities that are absolutely essential no matter what you end up doing with your life, like being able to marshal your own executive functioning and focus, being able to withdraw and make meaning and reflect, being able to apply the things that you learn to new problems, being able to sort of follow and, you know, build enthusiasm for something and then follow that enthusiasm and have what it takes, as my grandmother would have said, to follow a path that you're interested in. And then the ability and the skills to know how to you know, develop and assess your own knowledge within a domain that you're interested in. And so the idea behind really effective education is not that we need to cram a whole lot of knowledge or even procedural knowledge about how to take tests and things into kids, but that we need to produce kids who are capable of understanding what learning is and who know how to do it effectively for them. And we, in order to do that, you need a lot of experiences doing it. And we oftentimes don't give kids enough experiences actually controlling and monitoring and driving and owning their own learning. And so that's what I try to say to schools, is that if you want kids to really understand math, give them a curriculum in which they can move about within the space of math and discover and build and construct and revisit and fail and rebuild and fail and rebuild and make meaning and represent it to their friend and then come back. They need to be much more active and much more purposeful in the way that they acquire skills and knowledge and assimilate them into who they are, and much less passive recipients of information.
And all those other things that you know about from dealing at USC and also with colleagues here at the TDLC, things like spacing effects, when information should be relearned, so on. Things like exercise, the importance of exercise, things like music and cognition, and so on and so forth. Those are yes, they're academic areas and study, but
you can study them, but they're habits of mind that you hope that people can develop. You know, habits of physical activity and expectations of themselves that become built into your identity. And they're not sort of superimposed in a kind of superficial, fragile way, but they're actually a piece of the fiber of who you are and become as an adult.
Yeah. So what would your vision be? I mean, I know you have to go now and get back, but I mean, do you have some optimistic sense of the way things are going? I mean, do you have some vision of where you would like to see the education? It's a large question, I know, but what's the kind of environment that you... An environment in which... not only in the home, but in the school, will produce the most flourishing in your children.
Yeah.
And is there a formula?
There's a logic behind it. So it's not a content-based formula. It's a way of being and thinking about learning and about living. And what I would like to see is, I mean, there are sort of concrete ways in which you can instantiate this, but what I would really like to see is more tolerance of variability, more expectation of children taking control of their own learning and choosing topic areas to specialize in and demonstrating their learning in much more open-ended ways that more closely reflect what they have to do in the real world, but that also give them the freedom to build representations of their own knowledge that are more meaningful than just simple demonstrations that somebody else gives to you to kind of fill in and hand back. So where you really actually create a demonstration of your knowledge, these kinds of portfolio kinds of assessments, for example, and much more dynamic flexibility around what and how kids learn. We try to sort of standardize and control things to the point where we're losing what kids bring to the world that really is unique and potentially innovative, and we're washing that out. And I see a lot of almost fear of letting go of the control for fear that we'll lose any little bit of quality that we have in our poorest school districts. And what I think we need to do is, two contradictory things at once, if I can kind of describe it that way, and I hope it comes out clearly. So on the one hand, we need people to kind of let go of the tight control that's focused on standardizing, and on the other hand, have much higher intellectual expectations for both the students and the teachers. And I know that's not cool to say, but that's what I believe. The more I'm in schools, the more I see it. That I think that we really, if we want to have teachers who can foster and grow and develop children who are really critical thinkers, who are motivated, who are purposeful, who are using their learning for something, who know what they know what they don't, know what it feels like to understand something and know what it feels like to be curious and have the grit to be able to follow their curiosities in a systematic, hardworking way, we also need to expect that of teachers. We need teachers who are intellectually curious people, who love children and love learning and love to understand things in a deep way, and who have had the experience of understanding things in a deep way, and who can model that kind of flexibility and hard work and disciplinarity for their students. And I think that if we have, and there are many, many teachers who do fit this description, if we have that kind of intellectual curiosity and rigor of thinking among our model learners, then that will be modeled for the children who are learning, and they will be able to have more varied experiences around owning their own learning that will make the learning more long-lasting, more generalizable, and that potentially will lead to things like new inventions and new ways of thinking about problems that we can't have seen before. So what I think is that rather than standardizing and tightening the way in which we present information to our children as a way to improve education, I would destandardize, allow much more variability, both across teachers' styles and across students' styles, but have very, very high expectations for the intellectual quality of thought and for the rigor of effort and thought that goes into producing these kinds of knowledge that kids have.
Can't follow that. Mary Helen Imodini-Yang, thanks very much.
No, you're welcome. Always a pleasure.
Let's hope that message gets across.
Okay.
Good to see you again.
You too.